Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 93 of Speaking of Mysteries. Recently, Les Klinger and I sat down for lunch and a chat with Greg Sutter, who edited the recently published Library of America anthology of four of the late Elmore Leonard's novels. For more than 30 years, Greg was Leonard's researcher. It's the kind of gig that elicits envy among mystery fans in general and Elmore Leonard fans in particular. And for the most part, those two groups are identical. If there was a Venn diagram of crime fiction fans and fans of Elmore Leonard, the circles would pretty much align. People often asked him how he got such a great gig. At one BoucherCon, someone actually said to Greg, "I'd kill to have your job." It was such a great line. Greg told Les and me he would like to make it the title of the memoir he's writing about working with Elmore Leonard. Greg did a series of podcasts with Elmore, and I strongly suggest that you take a listen. I'll post the link to the podcasts on the Speaking of Mysteries website. Elmore Leonard may have passed from this life, but his work is eternal. Here's Greg Sutter.
How did you get hooked on mysteries in general?
Well,
did it start for you?
Well, you know, I recall the day that I had this waspy roommate, Jim Ashby. And he would always sit in his chair at his apartment above the ice cream store in downtown Rochester, Michigan. And he would always be reading Joyce's Ulysses, you know. And I can still remember just Jim sitting there.
It's a long book.
Huh? Yeah.
It's a long
book. Yeah. Right. And then one day, he's reading, I believe it was, Trouble Is My Business, which was in the early 70s. There was this great reprints of Chandler with these beautiful covers. I can't remember the artist's name, but I always wanted to own some of those covers. And it's like, huh? You know, I mean, you know, who is this guy? You know, Raymond Chandler. And then, you know, sort of, I had a mentor, a guy named Russell Ryan, and Russ was always like one step ahead of everybody in terms of, you know, the things he would listen to. We'd be listening to like Led Zeppelin, he'd be listening to Captain Beefheart, you know, I mean, always something like more obscure. And I can't recall the soup that we were all in, but I mean, it was like, it just sort of evolved. I mean, Russ ended up going to Albany, but he was a book collector, and he was into like Rex Stout and all these guys, and Woolrich just kind of like landed on my desk one day, you know, and it's like I just really, it resonated with me. But then I also loved collecting. I loved going to old Salvation Army and just finding books, and so somewhere around 75, I got a copy of 52 Pickup in paperback by Elmore Leonard, you know, and learned, you know, he's a local guy, and, you know, and it was, you know, hard-boiled suspense. I mean, by that time, I'd already been sort of indoctrinated into the Chandler Hammett school, and it, you know, it just grew from there, and, you know, I wasn't really like, I mean, I really wasn't that much in the Leonard canon at that moment,
right?
And then I moved up to Lansing. I had a job up there as an industrial liquidator. And then after that dried up, I ended up working on the line at Oldsmobile. And I collected. There was a great bookstore in East Lansing called Curious Books, which, you know, Don Yates would know well. I mean, but I would go there, I would draw my pay, and then the next morning I'd be at, because I worked nights, afternoons, I'd be in Curious Books, buying pulps, buying, you know, just collecting all the guys, all the hard-boiled guys, all the black mask guys, and just, you know, whatever I could afford. And so when Unknown Man number 89 came out, and like the bad guys were going down Main Street in Rochester where I lived, and they actually went right by where my apartment was, and like blew out the windows in Mistelfeldt's department store. It was like you know that song Hank Williams, You Wrote My Life. It was like, wow, this guy's following me around. You know, I mean, he mentioned the Lysander Apartments where we would go and smoke dope with the professors, and you know, and all these places that I knew. You know, and it was like a sense of place, really, and that was important when you're from Detroit, because you know, I mean, even though you had Motown, it was still flyover. You know, everything that happened, in either Hollywood or, you know, New York. Jim Morrison didn't live in Detroit. Of course, Iggy Pop did, you know, so we had some great, there were great things about Detroit, but you still had that sense of, like, in a literary sense, you know.
So you were a collector?
Yeah. Collector, yeah.
Did you decide to try your hand at writing?
I did, but it never really worked out for me. I mean, I made some false starts, and you know, I just never, you know, never really, I didn't know what it took. I mean, you know, I mean, it was always this tortured kind of, you know, reading Nathaniel West. You know, you don't think, oh, gee, I'll just write this book and I'll write another book and I'll write another. It was sort of like a literary parasite in a way. I mean, going to go into the story about how I met Elmore, or do you want to?
We'll come to Elmore. I want to talk more about you first.
Okay.
But you're now about to, you're writing the biography.
Well, I'm not writing a biographical memoir or a memoir, which is more accurately describing what, I'm not writing the big biography.
Okay, but even so, you're going to write.
I can write. I just haven't, and I have a, there's this great woman writer named Marion Roach Smith, who started writing memoir when her mother got Alzheimer's, and she really, really gave me a lot of confidence about writing a memoir, about writing about just how lucky I was to have worked for Elmore for all these years. I mean, just what a privilege it was. And I've always thought if I wrote the book, it would be called something that like through the years, I mean, people would go, oh, I'd love to have your job. How'd you get the job? How do I train to have a job like yours? And then at VoucherCon 2000, a librarian type came up to me and said, I'd kill to have your job. And I thought, well, that's it. You know, I mean, you'd have to kill me. But,
you're my kind of writer. You're a nonfiction writer. So this is not everybody has to write fiction.
Right. And but I just love, I mean, I made, you know, I made peace with myself and just really devoted myself to what I did with Elmore. I mean, it was, you know, it was he would bring you into the process. I mean, it was really, you know, it was like a, you know, like a, it wasn't like exactly like, I wouldn't call it father-son exactly, but I mean, it was just a very warm environment to be in, you know.
So you discovered that he was stalking you literally, and what, you sought him out?
Well, this is a bizarre connection with something, one of your publications, but Russ and I, who, you know, he was in New York, I was in Lansing, but we kept in touch, and then I don't know if he came back, but in the we had done a, Russ and I had been involved with others in college newspaper, like a zany radical kind of newspaper, and then we did an arts magazine in Detroit in 75 together with others, and then Russ said, let's start a zine. Remember zines?
Sure.
Like the website of the day or whatever. And let's call it Noir.
Okay.
Okay.
No, name wasn't taken.
And so, you know, and we actually, I still had the mock-up of the first cover, and Cornell Bullrich is on the cover with his Edgar. And so let's do our first interview. Let's interview Elmore Leonard. And at that point, you know, he was in the book. I mean, he wasn't hard to find. So Russ and I, he was divorced and living in an apartment building in downtown Birmingham. So Russ and I went up there. Russ, of course, you know, being a little more serious about collecting than I was, had a whole box of books to be signed. We talked, and he gave both of us copies of Gunsights, his Western that he wrote in the late 70s during his Detroit period. And I said to him, you know, I'm in the library a lot. You know, if you ever need any research, you know, like, let me know. You know. So that just kind of like hung there. We never ended up doing noir. We just kind of went our separate ways, and I ended up marrying and moving to Detroit, starting to do some freelance writing, you know, some for monthly Detroit magazine. And I wanted to do a profile on Elmore for monthly Detroit because nobody had really done any serious profiles. And the editor said, no, that's my story. And so I thought, oh, boy.
Oh, editors.
And so, as it happened, I was still in Lansing at that time. This was after we met Elmore. And so I was still in Lansing, and then I moved to Detroit, and then the editor changed. And it was this guy named Bob Pizer, who was an author and a TV guy, a great guy. And he loved Elmore. He said, go for it. Catherine Rambeau was the actual editor, and just a really great experience. I ended up embedding myself in Elmore's world, the world of City Primeval. And I went, we went to the locations, we went to Homicide, you know, and met all the cops that he had interviewed. Because Elmore wrote this great article for the Detroit News Sunday magazine in September of 78 called Impressions of Murder. And he just, you know, it read like his fiction, you know, and it became like almost like the treatment for City Primeval, High Noon in Detroit, which was when he was flirting with police procedural, and he never really went down that road. But and so I did this article, and that was in October of 88, came out, and then in January of 81. He called the Monthly Detroit office, which I just happened to be there. I wasn't a staffer. I just happened to be there. He said, hey, you want to do some research for me on stress? Now, it's not like stress. It's an acronym for Detroit Police Squad. It stood for Stop the Robberies, Enjoy Safe Streets. And stress was a granny squad. They would just, you know, it was filled with a lot of, you know, like brutality and stuff as they tried to entrap people and so on. And that was the research for Split Images, which was the follow-up to City Primeval, and where Raymond Cruz, the lieutenant, would be carried over. But then H.M. Swanson, his agent, said, you know, you're not going to be able to sell this book because United Artists will own the character. So he changed Raymond Cruz's name to Brian Hurd and lightened his mustache, as he famously said. But the proofreader left one Raymond in the book. So it's like, you know, Brian said, Raymond, who's Raymond, you know? So that was funny.
So how did the research thing work? I'm thinking about it from the writer's standpoint. So you did all this research, what, you write up a portfolio?
Yeah, but it's not really, with Elmore is that nobody, and any writer, worth his salt, or Myers herself. It's not about, like, doing all of his research. It's like Elmer was very easily distracted. So it's kind of like the best way to describe it at the beginning would be all of his library research, because life was research for Elmore, and anybody that came within his, you know, sphere would be tagged for something. They'd have to have some kind of, you know, there's something interesting about that person, you know. And his second wife, Joan, who he married, you know, he married just before I got married in 79, fall of 79, and then she passed in January of 93. But Joan was this great truth editor. Joan also brought him conversations from the ladies' room, which really, you know, Elmore had.
Now that's the name of the novel.
Yeah. Elmore had a, as most guys, right, in the 70s, 60s, 70s, especially of that generation, you know, I mean, they, you know.
Couldn't relate to women.
Well, they couldn't. They couldn't relate to women in a, and I don't want to get political, but in a non-sexist, overtly sexist way. Kathy Werbelow, who was a reporter for the Detroit Free Press, was reviewing his 78 novel, The Switch, and said something to the effect of that he had the you know, the sensibilities and the sensitivity of a Mickey Spillane. And of course, Elmore was, you know, that's not true, you know. But I'll give it some thought. You know,
there were so many writers of that period that just, that women were just so cardboard.
Yeah, they, yeah, yeah. So
that wasn't just mystery genre; it was across.
No, the board. I
was a big Isaac Asimov fan back in those days, and you know, he just couldn't write women.
So Joan really, I think, helped him a lot. And with that, and you know, you see, like, you know, the culmination of that in Killshot with Carmen, you know, she's now the you know, she's smarter than her husband, and it's not a problem, you know, for either one of them. That was such a travesty, though. Bruce Willis wanted to shoot that in the late 80s. He goes, "I love you. I won't change a thing." Except, of course, the ending where the woman does the, you know, takes care of business, you know, because you can't be Bruce Willis and have, like, you know, be upstaged at the end of the movie. And then when John Madden finally filmed it, they had to compromise, and then it was that they both shot at the same time.
Right.
Oh, that was a. That was a Harvey Weinstein botched, you know, movie surgery job. That's that movie.
So we were digressing. We were talking about research. And so did you also get sort of involved in the book with that? Or?
Well, at first, like in Split Images, I was really trying to, you know, overperform. You know, like Walter Kuza, who said, "I'm a Hamtramck Pollock, and there's nothing I can do about it." You see, Hamtramck, you know Hamtramck?
No.
Hamtramck is a city, there's two cities inside of Detroit, city limits, Hamtramck and Highland Park. And Hamtramck was traditionally a Polish Eastern European enclave. Dodge, Maine was in Hamtramck. You know, so it was like, you know, I mean, it was just really, you know, growing up, I mean, it was just synonymous with being Polish, you know. And, you know, and there's this love, there's this kind of like, you know, I mean, I grew up like German, and, you know, there was always this like, you know, you would sort of make fun of the Poles, but you would also like love their culture, you know. I mean, you know, like, you know, love a good polka, it was like a Polish wedding was considered to be like something really cool to attend. But Walter said that, and I was hanging out in Hamtramck, because Hamtramck in the late 70s, mid to late 70s and 80s was also where all the punk clubs were. And I was, you know, into, you know, I mean, Detroit, MC5, Iggy Pop, you know, I mean, it was, you know, punk rock, and there were a million groups that never made it out of Detroit. And one bar in particular, it was Lily's 21, and so, like, if you go into Lily's during the day, there'd be like a couple, you know, old guys at the bar, you know, drinking some of these horrible Mohawk liqueurs and things, you know, or a beer and a shot, and, you know, and ranting about Stalin or something. And you'd go there at night, and, you know, it would be the, you know, just, you know, like just a total punk culture. And so that's when I learned, I think early on, is to bring Elmore into my world, or worlds that I knew that he should know. So in Hamtramck, and Lily, the proprietor, Lily Karwoski, was a amazing woman who had survived all kinds of ordeals during the war. But, you know, always wore a tiger stripe dress, you know. She's sort of like, she had a kind of a John Waters kind of presence to her. But, and I actually created a band called the Pagan Babies, which he later used as a title, and wrote a song for that they would have performed, and did all these details. And, you know, I thought, oh, God, he'll use all this stuff, you know. Well, but he was just like, you know, just a picky eater, you know. He's just like, pick, but he'd find little things here and there, you know. And sometimes, you know, you do all this research, and it would be like on out of sight, you know. I did all this research on boxing, you know. Like, we actually went to the Kronk, and, you know, where Tommy Hitman Hearns worked out and everything, you know. And, all this stuff, and he goes, you know what fascinates me is the cut, man. And so, you know, but the idea is that you would blanket, you would throw out a big net of stuff, and then he would find something in there. And that was the kind of way that we worked. Boy, you know, when he was in the 80s, I mean, he could really work.
So it started out as basically research, and then it changed?
Well, the relationship. The relationship was a long time, you know, getting to the point where it was, you know, in recent times. But because he had, you know, his life, you know, I mean, Joan, he was very content, you know, in the 80s when he was really making his bones, you know, with the National, you know, with Glitz, New York Times bestseller, you know, when he became. I mean, he wasn't, you know, when I started out, my interest in him, he wasn't well known yet. I mean, Newgate Calendar, which was a pseudonym for the music critic of the New York Times, you know, reviewed Anno Man of 89 and said he could write circles around anybody in the genre today. So he was getting noticed, but it wasn't until he hooked up with Don Fine. Did you know Don Fine, the editor? At Arbor House, that those Arbor House years really when he ramped up to get to Glitz and Bandits.
Appraising Elmore's work, why is it that so many of his books have been made into films?
Have been. Because of a misconception that you can take a story that in its most pure form is internal dialogue and somehow externalize that without losing the essence of what Elmore is. And no one is, you know, very few people have been able to do that. They have to be masters of, you know, themselves.
Who's buying them?
Huh?
I don't know, I haven't done the math, but I suspect he sold more books to the Hollywood than any other writer in the late 20th century.
Well, we often discuss that, and that very well may be true. I mean, Stephen King may.
Oh, okay. So, what is it about the way that he writes?
It's cinematic. That's what it is. All you can say is that it's like a movie. The book is like a movie. He writes in scenes like a movie. That's what he always said. And then when they buy it, the first thing they're trying to do is figure out how to tell the story, how to, like, you know, sort of like a conversion, a software conversion. Now we got the story, we got the linear story, because it doesn't start with story. It starts with characters. And then it gets them to talk, and then it gets them to talk to each other. And then the story comes out of that. Not like, oh, here's my... I mean, yeah, he'll have ideas for a story. You know, like, I want to do a... In their Tishomingo Blues, he goes, I've been thinking about doing a high diver. A guy that jumps 80 feet into 9 feet of water. Go find me one. And so I did, and then found out that they were setting up down at Panama City Beach, the Miracle Strip Amusement Park. We went there right before Memorial Day, watched him set up the tower. That evening, we watched a guy jump 80 feet. The water wasn't lit properly, and he was injured. How do you call it? If you land wrong, you get a 50,000 gallon enema. Or something to that effect, yeah.
Nobody writes dialogue like Elmo.
That's the ear.
I think, my own little theory is that smart movie producers, those who develop films, understand that dialogue is everything. You can do all the special effects, you can do all the... I mean, it doesn't really even matter what the story is. And there's so many mystery films that have been made where it's like you look back at the plot and say, what? It didn't quite work. The mystery didn't, but the dialogue is
But you
fabulous.
Remember the lines. I think Greg makes a really good point with character. I mean, the story of how he developed Karen Sisko has been often told. He saw a photograph of a federal marshal standing on the steps.
Well, I had clipped this in the mid-80s. Women with guns, it's just kind of like seeing this woman, like, you know, with this Mossberg shotgun cocked on her hip, like just guarding a biker cocaine trial in Miami. And I just put it in my, in my research folder, and then 9 or 10 years later, I sent it to him, and he said, she's a book. I mean, that was that inspiration, that, you know.
Who doesn't like women with guns? Nancy, back to your point about characters, I mean, I think what makes great dialogue is that the dialogue is revealing of fascinating, interesting characters. And it almost doesn't matter what they do after that. It's just, you're hooked by the characters.
Well, Waylon Givens, I mean, probably the character that most people are familiar with is Waylon Givens from Justified.
Absolutely.
They used to wear, everybody wore a bracelet that said, what would Elmore say?
It was a blue bracelet that had WWED on it. What would Elmore do?
What would Elmore do? And that's how the writers, the actors, did their best to channel. And I think they probably did a good job.
They did a great job. And really, the majority of the credit goes to Graham Yost, who totally loved Elmore. And really, I call it Elmore Leonard U, that writer's room. Because they had every book, they would circulate all of his books. They didn't just read Raylan novels, and of course the short story, which Graham just said, sometimes he would just type. You know, he didn't even have to change anything. It was so perfect, And then the credit going further back goes to Carl Beverly and Sarah Timmerman, who, brought it to John Landgraf at FX, who had been on Karen Sisko, the show, which was really cut. A lot of times shows, find their footing. That show was just about to find its footing, and then ABC pulled the plug.
So what was Elmore's favorite of all of the adaptations?
Well, of course, we'll separated in terms of.
And then don't ask about yours.
Movie and TV.
Right.
And movie wise, it was Jackie Brown. Because he felt that Tarantino put the book on the screen. Which, if you try to explain that to somebody, you just have to, like, nod like you did.
Yeah.
That you understand what I'm saying.
I understand what you're saying.
Without trying to explain it further. Barry Sonnenfeld was the first. I mean, we have, like, sort of like the big three, which is Get Shorty, Jackie Brown, Out of Sight. In the order that they came out. Get Shorty made up for Stick. Stick was supposed to be a breakout, but because of the way Hollywood works, they sold it. And Burt Reynolds, who was the character Stick, could have been Stick if he was Stick. But I mean, if he had been directed by a real director with some experience. But he chose to be the director, and all he did is every time somebody said something funny, they cut away to George Segal, you know, like laughing and snarking, and that's just, you know, and Elmore, you know, just owned that picture, and he famously wrote Burt Reynolds a letter. He was sitting in the restaurant at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and Sidney Poitier came by and said to Elmore, "What are you doing?" Because Elmore knew Sidney, like he was good friends. Sidney Poitier was good friends with Walter Mirisch, who Elmore had, you know, done Mr. Majestic with, and they were going to do La Brava together. And Elmore said to Sidney Poitier, "I'm writing a letter to Burt Reynolds. He says, well, be honest." And Elmore wrote this beautiful, diplomatic, scathingly diplomatic letter. And later on, Burt Reynolds was on like Good Morning America or something. And he goes, "I don't know what happened with that guy. You know, I signed all his kids' autographs. You know, autographs for all his kids. You know, he turned on me. But he told Barry Sonnenfeld. Barry asked him for any advice, and he said, "Somebody says something funny, don't cut away because they don't know they're being funny." And Barry said, "Okay," and he didn't let Travolta dance. Because Travolta reportedly wanted to dance in that movie.
He was still in his dancing days.
That's true. But at least he didn't wear a white suit. Well, maybe he did.
He did sort of wear a white suit.
Yeah, he sort of did.
So. And Get Shorty was a hit, and it was considered to be a crime comedy. That's how they pegged it, you know. And then, of course, Quentin, who wanted to do Rum Punch, which became Jackie Brown, back when he was shooting. Well, we had all seen Reservoir Dogs. Elmer was knocked out by it. We all were. And then, he said to Elmer's agent, "You know, I'd really like to, because Rum Punch had just come out." He goes, "I'd really like to do Rum Punch." And, you know, "Well, you don't have any money, kid, but, you know, when you do," but he didn't call him kid because the agent was a kid. Pulp Fiction came out, and it's like Harvey, you know, opened up his wallet and, you know, got him all these options, all this stuff, you know, like Kill Shot, Freaky Deaky. And so that was that. So I saw Quentin at the premiere party, and said, "Man, congratulations, you really split the difference with Elmore." And that was really with a half and half kind of situation. And of course, Soderbergh, you know, and Scott Frank, you know, and Stacey Scher, and I mean, they crafted something which, you know, that was, you know, a romantic version of Elmore. Which is also like beloved by a lot of people.
Did he have any input on Be Cool?
That was horrible. I mean, it was a horrible experience all around. Jersey Films was breaking up. Literally, Danny DeVito was breaking up with Stacey Scher and Michael Shamberg, and there was just no oversight to the extent that. That somebody said, "No, you're not gonna turn this into a hip hop, you know, thing." Be Cool was could have been like a quiet little picture that would carry forward, get Shorty, you know, without a lot of fanfare. Travolta would have the older love interest as, you know, the studio woman, Elaine. The Stone Coyotes, which was the band that Elmore had actually commissioned, this band. They wrote a song for the book. And we did a thing at the Viper Room where Elmore read from Be Cool, and Stone Coyotes played. And I did a CD of it. I called it Music from the Book. And it, you know, I mean, it was like, you know, it was like this band, this simple band that Elmore could understand. Their sort of thumbnail was AC/DC meets Patsy Cline, and Elmore loved that, and he could understand that. And you know, it would have been a little movie, and instead, it became like a travesty at every. Elmore would always say that no movie of mine should have Cedric the Entertainer in it.